The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner, still reporting to you from the U.S. Social Forum here in Detroit. Today we spoke with Sumita Mukhopadhyay, who is the executive editor of Feministing.com, a really fascinating young feminist blog and website. And here's a really fascinating conversation we had with her that ranges about feminism, this conference, and much more. We are continuing our coverage of the U.S. Social Forum, and it's great to have Feministing.com here at the U.S. Social Forum and their editor with us, Sumita Mukhopadhyay. Sumita, it's great to meet you in person and here at this forum.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. I was reading your blogs leading up to your coming here, and you were psyched from the beginning about being part of this and being here. Talk about, I'm interested in your excitement about this forum and being here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I go to conferences all year long, right? I go to technology conferences, I go to activist conferences, I go to blogger conferences.
Ad nauseum almost, right?
Yeah. And Social Forum is really exciting because it's a collaboration of a really specific subset of activists that are dedicated to not only on-the-ground organizing, but also authentic media production, uplifting youth voices, and it's just so creative and so inspiring that, and so many people gathering, and I love Detroit. I've been here 3 times, and the activist work that's happening here is incredible. It's beautiful. The history of the city is so rich, and I was really excited to have the opportunity to kind of spotlight it at Feministing and meet so many amazing young activists and organizers. So
that's the interesting thing about this place is the numbers of people in their teens, 20s, and 30s that are populating the social forum, along with people like me who are older and everything in between. But I mean, talk about what that says to you about this place.
I mean, I think it's a measure of the quality of the people that are here, right? Mm-hmm. And the kind of work that they're doing. So you have a lot of youth organizers here, you have a lot of voter organizers here, people who are doing electoral work, people who are doing direct advocacy work and have actually organized their constituencies to come here. And a lot of them are teenagers and they're really engaged, and they've actually been able to successfully channel a lot of that energy and anger and frustration they have with being disenfranchised and being kind of disconnected from the political system into something really productive. And so it's not even like youth that are here. There's youth, groups, school groups that are here, and they're doing really creative things. Like they're producing media. They're, there's a bunch of hip hop. There's so much exciting stuff happening. So
yeah. We talked before you open these mics together that media like your site, Feministing, and we're here, and Free Speech is here, and some others of that. But there's almost this drought in terms of national media not being here covering this at all. I'm curious about your thoughts of that as a person, as a woman in journalism.
Yeah.
And not even the Huffington Post and Nation magazine, they're not like swarming over this place either. So what do you think that's about? What do you think is going on here?
I think that it's part of the division in the left, that there's, this is a little bit more of a progressive space in terms of being focused on the ground organizing, whereas I think a lot of progressive media is focused on more electoral work, right? They're focused on lobbying, policy, what's happening in D.C., what's happening on the Hill. They don't have their ear to the ground, and that's the reality. It's an unfortunate reality because there's so much capacity and potential for connection between what's happening here at the Social Forum, which is, these activists and organizers are actually trying to vet out a holistic, progressive agenda that includes the most disenfranchised voices, something the mainstream liberal movement has kind of failed to do. And so there's a bit of a division, and I think it's, there's no way that it's not strategic on some level, because we've done so much media for the Social Forum that people haven't heard about it. Everyone's heard about it, and there's 20,000 people gathering in one place.
That's phenomenal. 20,000
phenomenal.
People.
It is phenomenal.
In Detroit.
Yeah.
And I've said this to almost everybody we've talked to. You get 500 teabaggers, and the media's all over for 10 days.
Exactly.
You get 20,000 people in Detroit, and no one's talking
about
it.
Exactly. And that's a problem. That's a problem. So I do think part of it is not having the capacity to talk about progressivism as a spectrum, right? And understanding that this is a more far-left, grassroots-oriented group of people. And it's kind of easier to ignore it, I guess.
And I think it sometimes can be easier to dismiss, maybe because there are so many younger people here.
Yeah, and it's younger people. It's mostly led by people of color. That's a lot of it.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of young people of color in this place. And I think that what I want to say to some people who are like Katrina VanderHeuvel and some of the others who are older and run established wonderful mm-hmm. magazines like The Nation is that this was you 30 years ago.
Yep.
And it's still us. Yeah. But this was you 30 years ago.
I agree.
I want to let our listeners know a little bit about feministing. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of your writers have been on the show before.
Oh, great.
But talk about this blog site and what it is and the work you do.
Absolutely.
I have not heard about it yet.
Yeah. So Feministing is an online news resource and blog for young women to come and analyze and comment on news that affects their lives, policy, you know, programs, conferences. And we have, so we've been around for about 5 years, and I'm currently the executive editor. And we have 6 writers and 3 contributors and several columnists at this point. So our empire is growing.
Did you say empire?
Yes. And we have 500,000 readers a month. So we are the largest read feminist publication in the world as of right now.
Wow.
So it's really exciting.
That's
we're
amazing.
At a really exciting time.
So you wrote an interesting piece. It's a little diversion from mm-hmm. Social Forum, but I really found it fascinating because I've been trying to figure out an analysis of this myself, and I think you hit it, and I want you to talk about it. You talked about Nikki Haley, who will become the first Republican woman governor of South Carolina, and a woman of Indian descent.
Yeah.
And you had an interesting theory about Republican diversity, what all this means. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So Nikki Haley is, you know, that's like the rising star of the Republican Party right now. And a ton of bloggers were like, oh, you know, even South Asian bloggers, one at the Huffington Post said, well, this means that Republicans are better at playing identity politics. And so South Asians have, you know, a better chance of succeeding with Republicans than they do with Democrats, which I think overlooks the reality, which is that Republicans have a really bad legacy with race, and they will pretty much take any person of color that's willing to toe the party line. I mean, she's very conservative, right? And even though her, you know, on some level, it is amazing that she was able to win the primary. It is amazing. In that state, after being called a raghead by a state senator.
A Republican
state senator, you know, so there are people within the Republican Party that can't make sense of her and her identity. But at the same time, her politics are terrible, and they're not, you know, I don't think as a South Asian I should be like, oh, now I'm excited because this conservative South Asian, you know, and it's kind of been, Republicans have for a long time used South Asians or Asian Americans as this, you know, chess piece, right? This is the model minority, and this is how, you know, look at you blacks and Latinos, you should be acting like this, right? And so it's not really about diversity, it's just about politics for them. You know.
What do you think? How do you think this is going to play out nationally? I mean, in terms of her rise, also the push with Bobby Jindal, and I mean, I think there are 2 South Asian people who are representatives in the Maryland State Legislature. They're both Democrats, though. But
yeah.
But how do you think this is going to play out? What do you think this politically this means? What?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to bring a lot of conversations about the role of kind of the growing South Asian population in the United States and what their role is politically and as kind of the new voter hot group. Because I think it's really interesting that the 2 most visible are conservatives, right? Because the majority of South Asians in politics are left-leaning, mm-hmm. but they don't get publicity, right? And their names aren't Bobby and Nikki. Their names are... they go by their real names. I mean, not that those aren't their real names, but you know what I mean. Like, they go by their given name or their Indian name. And so...
they're not Samhita.
Right. Exactly, you know. So it's a combination of not just their politics, but also how they present themselves as very assimilated and Christian and really playing down the parts of them that are Indian, unless it's important to play it up, right? So I think it's going to bring up the conversation of, you know, where is this voter group going and who do we want representing South Asians in the government and that kind of stuff.
How does that, before we come back to this conference, how does that play out in the South Asian community now in terms of, because any group, there's always this tug about assimilation and becoming Americanized and changing your name and changing who you are in some levels. And that's always an immigrant struggle.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that South Asians are in a really unique position because it's an extremely diverse group of people and you know, it's 50 years of immigration patterns now, and each decade had a different reason for coming to the United States based on some kind of immigration law, right? So my parents came because at that time they were bringing, you know, highly educated people over, right? Mm-hmm. So they got in on student visas, whereas, you know, most of my friends whose parents came in the 80s were working class immigrants, right, who, you know, populated, like, the cities and that kind of stuff. So, you know, different communities had all different types of assimilation. So I grew up in the suburbs. I went by Sammy for the first, you know, 25 years of my life because I never grew up around Indians. Uh-huh. Whereas, you know, my friends who grew up in Queens, their entire high school was Indian, you know. So
right.
Yeah, I think it's really unique and specific to the different places. But I do think right now there is this current of South Asian identity building up and young people really wanting to identify as South Asian and holding on to pieces of their culture, but while still identifying as American. So we're kind of at an identity crisis right now.
But you very consciously went back to calling yourself Sam.
I did.
Calling yourself Sam.
I did. I had a trip to India, and I uh-huh. you know, in my early 20s, and my brother, who actually, his nickname was Bobby. And he started going by Sanjeev, and I started going by Samita, because we realized that our parents had given us those names to help us not get made fun of in school and stuff like that. And so, you know, we decided that we wanted to kind of go by our given names.
Were your parents happy about that, coming back to those names?
Yeah, you know, they were happy about it. In Indian culture, it's really common to have, like, cute nicknames, like Sammy and Bobby. So right. to them, they didn't really see it as... It did help us with assimilation, but it was also just our nicknames around the house. So, you know, they still call us Sammy and Bobby.
So talk a bit about the feminist work that's going on at this conference. You're part of a number of... workshops. Yeah. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah. So I actually, you know, we featured a lot of the posts, a lot of writing from the Gender Justice Working Group, which is
what?
It's a group of women of gender justice activists that basically work from anywhere in reproductive justice to, like, youth rights and sexuality and basically coming together to add gender justice to the progressive agenda. And so, yeah, we ran a series of pieces, and I actually haven't worked that closely with them. I'm really here talking about how progressives can use social media to change dominant perceptions of gender.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So basically what's missing in the mainstream media coverage of women's issues and racial justice, like race issues, and how can we use new and social media to cover those issues?
So... Listen, you said you weren't here. You didn't come to the conference to talk about feminist issues. You came to talk about
more broadly how to use these tools to address issues of feminism and race.
Because feministing.com clearly is.
Yeah, we're very bound to we're very bound to feminist identity. We take a lot of pride in being explicitly feminist, especially in a time when it's not very sexy to call yourself a feminist.
But, hence what circles you travel in. But
yeah.
But talk about. A little bit of your thoughts about one of the ways I was introduced to your blogs, your site, mm-hmm. feministing.com, was a former producer who worked for us, Jessica Phillips, who was a fanatic for your site.
Oh,
she said,
okay.
Have you ever heard of it? I said, I've heard it before. She said, read it. So I started reading it. And she was a woman in her late 20s, is a woman in her late 20s. And so it's an interesting conversation. I'm just curious your thoughts on this, the new generation of feminist thinkers and writers and activists, and how you all are different from or similar to the women who came before you.
Yeah, sure. I think we're definitely different in a lot of ways. And, you know, in terms of similarity, I think the big tent that is feminism is in all its diversity. Like, we would not be here if it were not for the work that the mm-hmm. women did before us and the generations before us. And I can't emphasize that enough, because I know there's a lot of tension between different generations of feminists and in terms of how we identify and what's, you know, the real feminist legacy. And there's still a lot of debate about that. But the reality is the people that have been doing the work for the last, you know, several hundred years, honestly, have gotten us to this place. In terms of difference, I do think that younger feminists have different issues on their plate. I think that you know, sexuality is really at the forefront in a way that it never has before, and women are being sexualized by the media, yet, you know, being shamed for being sexual at the same time, and that's something that young women have to navigate, and it's very unique to our generation. I think, you know, hookup culture and all the, like, demonization around that, and, you know, young women finding an authentic sexuality, I also feel like that's very unique to our generation. And also just the diversity. I think in the past, feminism has been very much considered this middle-class white women's movement, and I think that's really changed, and you see that there's other types of feminism that have kind of already existed that are finally being recognized, both in academic feminism and in activist feminism. So It's hard to say that there's one feminist movement at this point. I think it's, you know, really a diversity of people that identify as feminist but may not do specifically feminist work, or, you know, it's much more diverse.
So what do you think for yourself and for the women you work with are the most critical ideas, issues, things that you need to focus on mm-hmm. and change?
There's so many. I mean, so I think, you know, one of the biggest issues impacting young women right now is access to reproductive health, right, nationwide, mm-hmm. and access to rights over our body and making sure that those rights are guaranteed and supported by the government. So I think that's a huge issue. I think also, yeah, access to health care. So I'm actually writing a book.
About what?
It's about dating.
About dating?
Yeah. So I'm writing a book about feminist dating, and it's kind of a feminist intervention to mainstream dating books. And it's called Outdated.
I like that title.
Yeah. And I think that sexuality is a really... negotiating sexuality is mm-hmm. a huge issue for young women right now. Parsing through mainstream media representations of over-sexualized women mm-hmm. with trying to find an authentic sexuality through their romantic relationships, and, you know, all the kind of outlying realities of that, from sexual assault to domestic violence to, you know, just finding happiness. Mm-hmm. So there's no, you know, dominant narrative, right? There's no kind of like bigger story or bigger picture for how to understand and make sense of young women's sexuality without either shaming it, mm-hmm. demonizing it, or exploiting it in some way. Those mm-hmm. those are the only tools we have to decipher it.
So what do you so give me the other spin on that then. So where is it you think it needs to be, and what are you kind of really fighting for it to become?
Yeah, I mean, I think focus on self-esteem is huge. I think, you know, education around self-esteem issues and to really support women in becoming self-realized. You know, and becoming educated about their choices in their personal lives, and then also petitioning mainstream media for the way that they represent women, and advertisements like, you know, American Apparel, or these just like offensive ads that exploit young women's bodies to sell products, and
which they've always done on some levels.
They have, yeah, it's true.
But maybe it's just more intense now than it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's more, our culture is more intense,
right,
than it ever was, and. So it's more just, and, you know, sex sells. I get it.
Right.
I get it, you know, but there has to be a line drawn somewhere. There has to be some counter-representation of successful young women in the media as well.
So how does what you've just been describing mm-hmm. and tying that back into the U.S. social forum where we are now, what comes out of this place around that for you? What's the end result of that when you leave when this forum closes?
Well, I think... empowering young people with the tools to learn how to organize their communities, how to decipher mainstream media, how to create their own media, only helps them tackle these fights, right? So the more tools they have in terms of, the more empowered they are in terms of being leaders, the more tools they have in organizing their communities, and the more access they have to alternative and progressive media or their own media production, they're only going to continue building this kind of echo chamber of an alternative narrative, right?
So you think that this diversification of coming out of the establishment media kind of losing its hold mm-hmm. on the world is a positive thing. This new diversity, this kind of, some people see it as fragmentation,
absolutely.
But you see it as something else.
Absolutely. I think the rise of new media is one of the most exciting things that we've seen in media probably in 20 years. I think there needs to be, we need both things at the same time, right? Like, we need to reform mainstream media and make sure we still have hard-hitting investigative journalism, but this is the first time in our history that we actually have the tools to tell our own stories, and we have to fight to keep those tools, and we have to fight to tell those stories.
So, and that's why you're here, and that's what you're about to do.
Exactly.
So, Nita, thank you so much. It's really great to meet you
in
person.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Yeah. Thanks. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.